Welcome back to the Hemingway List, the podcast where we do things the Hemingway. In today's episode, we are discussing The Brothers Karamazov, Chapter 2, and then we will be reading Chapter 3. The questions that I asked you guys about Chapter 2 were these. So who is this Fyodor Pavlovich fellow, do you reckon? Embarrassingly, I'm already lost with who the characters are. It's not really a question, but send help. What year are we in here? Pyotr reflects on his youth, fighting in the Paris Revolution of 1848, so does that put us in the late 1800s? And a bonus question, did you have a favourite line from this chapter? Samostars said, I started a spreadsheet tracking the characters, their relationships, and some notes. Let me know if this link doesn't work. I'll keep that updated as we read as needed. Dude, that is so helpful. Let's have a look here. I've opened it up. We've got a Google Drive spreadsheet. Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov, father of Dmitry, Ivan, and Alexei, landowner well-known in his district, has a gloomy and tragic death, abject, vicious, senseless, but capable with his own affairs. I'm loving this already. All right, who's up next? I'm going to read all of these. There's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. If I can get my window to expand. There we go. All right. Dmitry Mitya Fyodorovich, Fyodorovich Karamazov. Jeez, everyone's got like 12 names. Eldest, we're going to need this spreadsheet. The eldest son of Fyodor, son of Adelaida Ivanovna. Abandoned by his dad when young, raised by a series of distant relations, raised with belief that he had property, Fyodor granted him some money when Dmitry came of age, but the boy had an exaggerated idea of his wealth, believes he has been deceived and or cheated, is temperamental, unruly, and impatient. Good to know. Good to know. Next up, we've got Ivan Fyodorovich Karamazov, the second son of Fyodor, the full brother of Alexei and half-brother of Dmitry. No notes on this one. Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov, oh my god, I'm bad at these names. The third son of Fyodor, full brother of Ivan, half-brother of Dmitry. No notes on him. Adelaida Ivanovna, first wife of Fyodor, mother of Dmitry, from a rich and distinguished noble family, also landowners, eloped with Fyodor but did not love him, hot-tempered, impatient, strong, left Fyodor for a poor divinity student and died suddenly of typhus or starvation, releasing Fyodor from marriage. She also beat him. She was a domestic abuser. I don't know if that's what I was looking for, but that'll do. And Peter. Is that just Peter? P-Y-O-T-R. Alexandrovich Miazov is the cousin to Dmitry's mother. Raised Dmitry for a while when very young, then abandoned him to a cousin, a liberal of the era, friends with Proud Hon and Bakunin, and fond of recalling the Paris Revolution. Has a grand estate, sues a nearby monastery, in part because he felt it was his duty to attack the clericals. It's Pyotr. I'm just going to say Pyotr. Cool, all right, hey. Samostars, thank you so much for that. There's also a document explaining how Russian names work. That is a very helpful one. I won't read through that now, but it explains it. And if you do look that up, I'm sure there's plenty of explanations on how Russian names work. It is very helpful. Samostars said, I found this super helpful when I started reading War and Peace. Yeah, me too. Once I realized that the middle name is basically the name of the person's father, plus Ovich for guys or Ovna for girls, it made it really easy to track the genealogies. It also helped me understand that female and male last names have variations in endings, so I could understand family relationships better that way too. It's really easy to understand relationships once you see how the names work. Yeah, so for example, just real quick. What was the surname? So there's Ivanovich or which is the son of Ivan. Or there's Ivanovna, which is daughter of Ivan, right, for example. So you could have a married person. Wait, what am I saying here? Anyway, yeah. You can tell if it's a girl or a guy by the Ovich or Ivanovna, and you can also tell who they are born to, who was their father. Very cool. Thank you very much for that, Semastars. Techrific said, Ander mentioned that his copy was missing the note from the author in the beginning. If anyone is interested, I made a hammy mock Russian reading of the note from the author for your amusement. Enjoy it if you can, and I apologize in advance. Still, it's better than if we were to read it in my own accent. Trust me. At least user Rockstar Bottom might enjoy it. Here's the link. It's a SoundCloud link. And I'm going to give you a little sampler here. I'll give you a little 5 seconds of it. I'm not sure how loud. Oh, here we go.
Even as I begin to relate the life story of my hero, Alexei Fyodorovich Karamazov, I feel somewhat perplexed. The reason is this.
I feel somewhat perplexed. Oh man, mine's even worse. That's cool, Tech. Hey, it's good to hear your voice, even if you are putting on a hammy Russian accent. That's pretty good. It's pretty convincing. I will listen to that at some point. And guys, you'll have to find this one via the subreddit. So go to reddit.com/r/theHemingway list, and in the chapter 2 discussion post, you'll find Techrific's link for that on the SoundCloud. That's probably the easiest way to find it. I am Norwegian said, I have read a fair amount of Bastiat, and through that I was familiar with Proudhon. Cool, okay, I'm already lost. Norwegian, Bastiat, let me do a quick search of that. Bastiat, Frederick Bastiat, was a French economist and writer who was also a predominant member of the French liberal school. Bastiat developed the economic concept of the opportunity cost. Oh, cool. And introduced the parable of the broken window. He was a Freemason and a member of the French National Assembly. Cool. That all makes sense. Now Proudhon. Who the heck was Proudhon? Sorry, guys. Proudhon, Pierre-Joseph Proudhon, was a French politician and the founder of mutualist philosophy. Oh, no, now I need to look that up. Mutualist philosophy is, of course, originated from the writings of the philosopher Pierre-Joseph Proudhon. Mutualists opposed the idea of individuals receiving an income through loans, investments, and rent, as they believe these individuals are not laboring. Okay, so they don't like people getting an income through passive assets, something like that. He was the first person to declare, this Proudhon guy, himself an anarchist, using that term, and is widely regarded as one of the ideology's most influential theorists. He's even considered by many to be the father of anarchism. All right, what a thing to be. I've read a few of their letters, says I am Norwegian, to each other. Huh? I've read a few of their letters to each other. Oh, okay, Bastiat and Proudhon. And I was struck by how very similar our political arguments are today. Back when I was figuring out my beliefs, I spent a lot of time discussing and debating libertarianism, anarchism, and socialism, and discovering that we were all having the same arguments centuries ago blew me away. Anyways, that's just an aside, but framing Pyotr by him knowing Proudhon let me understand him much better instantly. I also think it's interesting that right after describing Pyotr, knowing Proudhon and Bakunin personally, and how he was so proud of his direct involvement in the Paris Revolution, Dostoevsky goes on to describe his splendid estate and his endless attempts to sue for more property rights. Huh, it's kind of ironic now that we know who his contemporaries were, who his friends were. Pyotr is described as having been interested in Adelaide Ivanovna, but Ivanovna is his cousin, right? Were there not norms against this in 19th century Russia? Oh, hell no, there weren't. Cousins were kissing all over the place back in old Russia. If I've learned anything from War and Peace, it's that. Pyotr is described as having been interested in Adelaide. Oh, I just read that. My favourite line was this. Fyodor Pavlovich was all his life fond of acting, of suddenly playing an unexpected part, sometimes without any motive for doing so, and even to his direct disadvantage, as for instance in the present case. This habit, however, is characteristic of a great number of people, some of them very clever ones, not like Fyodor Pavlovich. I would encourage everyone to read up on Russian diminutive names. Yep, that is very helpful. Robert would equal Bob. In English, yep. Robert, nickname is Bob. In Russian, Dmitry might be shortened to Mitka or Mitya. And they're just basically nicknames. Russians also have the patronymic names. That's what we were talking about before. So Fyodor Pavlovich would be Dmitry Fyodorovich. Fyodor's father would have been Pavel, I think. I'm confused, but I know what you're saying. I do know what you're saying. Techrific said, cousin marriages were not uncommon, especially between second cousins. This was especially true among the wealthy because that was a way to ensure that the wealth was kept within the extended family. All of the Russian families of Europe are closely related, for instance. Only in modern times have they begun to wed commoners, thus bringing much-needed blood and genes to a quite frankly dodgy gene pool. Good to know. Thanks, Tech. Well said, I suppose. At least it was humorous. Swim said the mum of fishy said, the dad of the brothers. That's who Fyodor Pavlovich is. Oh, he's the dad of the brothers. The brothers Karamazov. Yeah, cool. I'm not being sarcastic right now. That actually just clicked into place in my head. Man, am I slow on the uptake. Cool. The brothers. They're the brothers. Holy shit. All right, I am stupid. Cool. All right, let's just pretend that never happened. A trick from War and Peace, from the War and Peace threads, says Swim, said the Mama Fishy. If you are reading an ebook and can't figure out who it is, do a search on the name. I've been doing this and it works great. Good to know. I'm not using an ebook though. I'm actually using the interior file PDF from the Hemingway list version of the book. From my reading, the majority of the book is set when the brothers are in their 20s, 13 years before the date of publication, so about 1866. The early chapters then are about 20 years earlier in the 1840s. Very cool, thank you, Swim, said the Mama Fishy. I am finding Dostoevsky's refreshingly breezy compared to Tolstoy's epic, sweeping historical War and Peace, and from Bronte's over-the-top gothic romanticity, and from Joyce's depressing, exhausting Dublin, and from Crane's crazy Swede and dead seamen. Although TBR will become darker and darker, I expect TBR, the brothers, TBK, did you mean? The brothers Karamazov? Will become darker and darker. I'd like that TBK, because saying the brothers Karamazov is a bit of a mouthful, so I'm going to go with that TBK. That seems to be the Hemingway list theme so far. Becoming darker and darker. Yeah. Oh, and I forgot Les Miserables. In 2019, I've been spending a lot of time in the 19th century. The great thing is there are no pop quizzes and five-paragraph essays involved or other annoying sundry assignments. I'm getting way deeper into these books this way than I ever did studying them at school, so this is pretty cool, I reckon. I'm not reading Les Mis, but there is a BBC version of it coming out, or it might have even come out already, and I think it might be made by the same production people as who made the War and Peace one, and that was really, really good. So I'm going to watch that at some point. Techrific said, early chapters, 20 years earlier, so around the 1840s. Yes, this is on track for the Paris Revolution of February 1848. And also, Hemingway's darkness, I definitely see it in all the works so far. Another thing I thought about, Hemingway was a sophisticated thinker, and so he knew that we don't just learn from the masterpieces, but we learn from flawed masterpieces and inferior writing too. We identified some technical problems with Bronte's prose and narration, so maybe he put it on the list for multiple reasons. Just a thought. Too bad we can't just ask him, said Swim, said the Mama Fishy. I think the flaws, if you're talking about the ones that I was harping on about, like the confusing narrators and that kind of thing. Those would be pretty contentious points. I think a lot of people would disagree with me on that. I don't know. But good thought. Anyway, Techrific. Very good. Dirt Burglar. Dirt Burglar. Are you new, Dirt Burglar? I don't think I've laughed at that name yet. Awesome name, Dirt Burglar, and welcome to the podcast. Oh, okay. I'm going to lead the very first sentence of your comment. I'm new to the Hemingway list. Cool. Okay, so you are new. Welcome aboard, Dirt Burglar. I look forward to saying your username as often as possible. I'm new to the Hemingway list, so please forgive me if I'm missing something obvious here. I saw that we will be reading this in segments that don't necessarily align with the chapters. How will I know what segment we're on? I read chapter 2, but now I'm not sure if I'm supposed to read all of chapter 3 today or only part of it. Thanks in advance. Good question. I would say, once I post the discussion forum for chapter 3, at that point you'll know where to stop reading because it'll say in the discussion forum. And from that point you'll have 24 hours to read the chapter. But the thing is, if you wanted to start earlier, like before that discussion forum is posted, in that case, you'll just sort of need to have a little bit of a guess, I suppose. You can tell quite easily, okay? So, for example, the first two chapters were, in my version, they were about 2.5 pages each. So I don't know what that equates to in your version, okay? But do the math. Check out what chapter one is, okay, for example. And then double that. So if chapter one in your version is 3 pages, think 6-ish pages, all right? 6-ish pages in your version. In my version, it would be 4-ish pages. If it goes much beyond that, if the chapter, let's have a quick look at the length of the chapter. If it's much more than that, I'll probably split it up. Okay, so if it's much more than double the length of chapter one, I will probably split it up. Okay, otherwise I won't. So chapter three, for example, is 5 pages in this, which is a little bit longer than double chapter one. No, it's not. Wait, chapter one was 2.5, 3, yeah. Cool. So what I'm saying is, like, there's an average chapter length of, in my version, about 3 pages, which is fine. If the chapter is 6 pages, double the average, I'll probably still do it in one go, right? But if it's really long, like if you have a look at the chapter and it's like 10 pages or 12 pages or something like that, I will most likely split it. Does that make sense? So just have a look at the chapter length. Compare it to the average. Because I can see as I scroll a bit further down the book, the chapters do become longer. There's some that are 6, 7, 8 pages. Today's chapter is, what is it? 5-ish pages. So I'll knock that off today. We'll read all of chapter 3. So, yeah, short answer is you can check the daily discussion forum, and as soon as I post that, there'll be 24 hours to read the chapter. So you do get a full day of knowing which bit we're going to be reading. It's just if you wanted to read a bit sooner than that, you might have to have a bit of a guess at where to stop. Now, look, if you go over, like if you say, oh yeah, it's an 8-page chapter, I'll just read the whole thing. And if we do happen to just do it in halves, then, you know, you're a little bit ahead. You can either have a day up your sleeve. It doesn't really matter. As long as we're roughly on the same page, to pun not intended. Cool. Sorry I don't have an exact answer, like a proper reading schedule. But the thing is, I haven't been able to like break down chapters into chunks and make a schedule because I haven't read the book and I also don't want to read ahead and spoil anything. So yeah, we'll just play it by ear a bit. But the thing I learned with War and Peace is as long as everyone is like 95% in the same place in the book, the discussions will be fine. Like we'll be able to talk about where we're up to. We'll never be more than a couple of minutes of reading away from each other. Savvy kid, said Fyodor Pavlovich, seems incredibly selfish, either that or is embracing the last line of chapter one. Extremely naive. It does not seem he loved his first wife, but merely enjoyed the attention he received after her death, so much so that he dismissed their son entirely and then later on in life swindled him out of his inheritance. It sounds like he puts himself first above all others for reasons we have yet to fully learn. This could possibly be motivated by the ill treatment society has given him his entire life, or perhaps he feels his son is the true villain, abandoning his father in a time of need. Who knows this far, really? The copy I have outlines all the characters as having two or three nicknames and explains that most are referred to by their first and middle names, hence Fyodor Pavlovich and not Fyodor Pavlovich Karamazov. That's handy to know as well. We'll get the hang of it, I think. I don't think this is going to be like one of those War and Peace things where there's 500 characters in the book. I think after a few chapters, we'll basically know the main players. Wasm said, losing whatever he gained from his first wife, does Pavlovich remarry in hopes of a more material gain? From the looks of it, it'd be something he'd do. Also, man, imagine, forgotten by your father, taken out of the house by a first cousin, only to be forgotten and dropped at some other family member's house. It's almost amusing. Dirt Burglar said, I'm curious to see what Dmitri's relationship with the other brothers will be like. I guess a lot of that will depend on how they're treated by Fyodor. I can't imagine they'll be ignored by him in the same way, but maybe that's better than the alternative of being actually raised by him. Rockstar Bottom said, you are my new favourite person, heh heh heh. I don't know who you're talking about there, Rockstar, but I'm just going to assume you mean me and feel flattered. So, thanks. Thanks for saying I'm your favourite person, which is definitely what you meant. Sue Dynamic said, who is Fyodor? My favourite line from this chapter says a lot about him. Fyodor Pavlovich was all his life fond of acting and suddenly playing an unexpected part. I think I already read this. Yeah, I did read this earlier. He's like a self-directed marionette. His life has direction only because he sets himself to play a role. Choosing when to be a father and when not to be, when to be dutiful to his property, how to indirectly address his son Dmitri's reckless spending, but his direction is a direct reaction to the present, with little foresight. Cool. Alright. That's the discussion about chapter 2. Sorry, I just was about to read another comment and I realised it was a bot. So, I didn't read the robot's comment. Excluding the robot's comment from the discussion, that does actually conclude the Chapter 2 discussion. Quickly, I'll remind you, Aaron Huggins, the man, the myth, the legend, the 15-year-old author from the Yarra Valley who I mentored from grade 6, his novel, very funny, it's Terry Pratchett, it's Douglas Adams meets Agatha Christie, a murder mystery set on an alien planet, hilarious, mysterious, very fun. It is available now for pre-order and comes out in 10 days. 10 days from today. So, Live a Little by Aaron Huggins. Go and check it out at upandupmedia.com.au. And I do thank you all sincerely to those who have already pre-ordered the book. You're making a massive difference in a young author's life. And mark my words, he will be a famous author. I guarantee you that. All right. That'll do. That's a good little plug, a little advertisement for the day. Now let's move on and read Chapter 3 of The Brothers Karamazov, which goes exactly like this. Chapter 3, The Second Marriage and the Second Family. Very shortly after getting his 4-year-old Mitya off his hands, Fyodor Pavlovich married a second time. His second marriage lasted 8 years. He took this second wife, Sofia Ivanovna, also a very young girl, from another province, where he had gone up upon some small piece of business in company with a Jew. Though Fyodor Pavlovich was a drunkard and a vicious debauchee, he never neglected investing his capital, and managed his business affairs very successfully, though no doubt not over scrupulously. Sofia Ivanovna was the daughter of an obscure deacon and was left from childhood an orphan without relations. She grew up in the house of a general's widow, a wealthy old lady of good position, who was at once her benefactress and tormentor. I do not know the details, but I have only heard that the orphan girl, a meek and gentle creature, was once cut down from a halter in which she was hanging from a nail in the loft. So terrible were her sufferings from the caprice and everlasting nagging of this old woman, who was apparently not bad-hearted, but had become an insufferable tyrant through idleness. Fyodor Pavlovich made her an offer. Inquiries about were made about him, and he was refused. But again, as in his first marriage, he proposed an elopement to the orphan girl. There is very little doubt that she would not on any account have married him if she had known a little more about him in time. But she lived in another province. Besides, what could a little girl of 16 know about it except that she would be better at the bottom of the river than remaining with her benefactress? So the poor child exchanged a benefactress for a benefactor. Fyodor Pavlovich did not get a penny this time, for the general's widow was furious. She gave them nothing and cursed them both, but he had not reckoned on a dowry. What allured him was the remarkable beauty of the innocent girl, above all her innocent appearance, which had a peculiar attraction for a vicious profligate who had hitherto admired only the coarser types of feminine beauty. "Those innocent eyes slit my soul up like a razor," he used to say afterwards with his loathsome snigger. In a man so depraved, this might, of course, mean no more than sensual attraction. As he had received no dowry with his wife, and had, so to speak, taken her from the halter, he did not stand on ceremony with her. Making her feel that she had wronged him, he took advantage of her phenomenal meekness and submissiveness to trample on the elementary decencies of marriage. He gathered loose women into his house and carried on orgies of debauchery in his wife's presence. To show what a pass things had come to, I may mention that Grigory, the gloomy, stupid, obstinate, argumentative servant, who had always hated his first mistress, Adelaida Ivanovna, took the side of his new mistress. He championed her cause, abusing Fyodor Pavlovich in a manner little befitting a servant, and on one occasion broke up the revels and drove all the disorderly women out of the house. In the end, this unhappy young woman, kept in terror from her childhood, fell into that kind of nervous disease which is most frequently found in peasant women who are said to be possessed by devils. At times, after terrible fits of hysterics, she even lost her reason. Yet she bore Fyodor Pavlovich two sons, Ivan and Alexei, the oldest in the first year of marriage and the second 3 years later. When she died, little Alexei was in his fourth year, and, strange as it seems, I know that he remembered his mother all his life like a dream, of course. At her death, almost exactly the same thing happened to the two little boys as to their elder brother, Mitya. They were completely forgotten and abandoned by their father. They were looked after by the same Grigory and lived in his cottage, where they were found by the tyrannical old lady who had brought up their mother. She was still alive and had not, all those 8 years, forgotten the insult done to her. All that time she was obtaining exact information as to her Sofia's manner of life and hearing of her illness and hideous surroundings, she declared aloud two or three times to her retainers, "It serves her right. God has punished her for her ingratitude." Exactly 3 months after Sofia Ivanovna's death, the general's widow suddenly appeared in our town and went straight to Fyodor Pavlovich's house. She spent only half an hour in the town, but she did a great deal. It was evening. Fyodor Pavlovich, whom she had not seen for those 8 years, came into her drunk. The story is that instantly upon seeing him, without any sort of explanation, she gave him two good, resounding slaps on the face, seizing him by a tuft of hair and shook him 3 times up and down. Then, without a word, she went straight to the cottage to the 2 boys. Seeing at the first glance that they were unwashed and in dirty linen, she promptly gave Grigory, too, a box on the ear, and announcing that she would carry off both the children, she wrapped them just as they were in a rug, put them in the carriage, and drove off to her own town. Grigory accepted the blow like a devoted slave, without a word, and when he escorted the old lady to her carriage, he made her a low bow and pronounced impressively that God would repay her for orphans. "You are a blockhead all the same," the lady shouted to him as she drove away. Fyodor Pavlovich, thinking it over, decided that it was a good thing and did not refuse the general's widow his formal consent to any proposition in regard to his children's education. As for the slaps she had given him, he drove all over the town telling the story. It happened that the old lady died soon after this, but she left the boys in her will 1,000 rubles each for their instruction, and so that all be spent on them exclusively, with the condition that it be so portioned out as to last till they were 21, for it is more than adequate provision for such children. If other people think fit to throw away their money, let them. I have not read the will myself, but I heard there was something queer of the sort, very whimsically expressed. The principal heir, Yefim Petrovich Polonov, the marshal of nobility of the province, turned out, however, to be an honest man. Writing to Fyodor Pavlovich and discerning at once that he could extract nothing from him from his children's education, though the latter never directly refused but only procrastinated as he always did in such cases, and was indeed at times effusively sentimental, Yefim Petrovich took a personal interest in the orphans. He became especially fond of the younger, Alexei, who lived for a long while as one of his family. I beg the reader to note this from the beginning, and to Yefim Petrovich, a man of a generosity and humanity rarely to be met with, the young people were more indebted for their education and bringing up than to anyone. He kept the 2,000 rubles left to them by the general's widow intact, so that by the time they came of age their portions had been doubled by the accumulation of interest. He educated them both at his own expense, and certainly spent far more than 1,000 rubles upon each of them. I won't enter into a detailed account of their boyhood and youth, but will only mention a few of the most important events. Of the elder, Ivan, I will only say that he grew into a somewhat morose and reserved, though far from timid, boy. At 10 years old he had realized that they were living not in their own home, but on other people's charity, and that their father was a man of whom it was disgraceful to speak. This boy began very early, almost in his infancy, so they say at least, to show a brilliant and unusual aptitude for learning. I don't know precisely why, but he left the family of Yefim Petrovich when he was hardly 13, entering a Moscow gymnasium, and boarding with an experienced and celebrated teacher, an old friend of Yefim Petrovich. Ivan used to declare afterwards that this was all due to the ardour for good works of Yefim Petrovich, who was captivated by the idea that the boy's genius should be trained by a teacher of genius. But neither Yefim Petrovich nor this teacher was living when the young man finished the gymnasium and entered the university. As Yefim Petrovich had made no provision for the payment of the tyrannical old lady's legacy, which had grown from 1,000 to 2, it was delayed, owing to formalities inevitable in Russia, and the young man was in great straits for the first 2 years at that university, as he was forced to keep himself all the time he was studying. It must be noted that he did not even attempt to communicate with his father, perhaps from pride, from contempt for him, or perhaps from his cool common sense, which told him that from such a father he would get no real assistance. However that may have been, the young man was by no means despondent and succeeded in getting work, at first giving sixpenny lessons and afterwards getting paragraphs on street incidents into the newspaper under the signature of Eyewitness. These paragraphs, it was said, were so interesting and piquant that they were soon taken. This alone showed the young man's practical and intellectual superiority over the masses of needy and unfortunate students of both sexes who hang about the offices of newspapers and journals, unable to think of anything better than everlasting entreaties for copying and translations from the French. Having once got into touch with the editors, Ivan Fyodorovich always kept up his connection with them. And in his latter years at the university, he published brilliant reviews of books upon various special subjects, so that he became well known in literary circles. But only in his last year he suddenly succeeded in attracting the attention of a far wider circle of readers, so that a great many people noticed and remembered him. It was a rather curious incident. When he had just left the university and was preparing to go abroad upon his 2,000 rubles, Ivan Fyodorovich published in one of the more important journals a strange article which attracted general notice on a subject of which he might have been supposed to know nothing, as he was a student of natural science. The article dealt with a subject which was being debated everywhere at the time, the position of the ecclesiastical courts. After discussing several opinions on the subject, he went on to explain his own view. He was most striking about the article. What was most striking about the article was its tone and its unexpected conclusion. Many of the church party regarded him unquestioningly as on their side, and yet not only the secularists but even atheists joined them in their applause. Finally, some sagacious persons opined that the article was nothing but an impudent satirical burlesque. I mention this incident particularly because this article penetrated into the famous monastery in our neighbourhood, where the inmates, being particularly interested in questions of the ecclesiastical courts, were completely bewildered by it. Learning the author's name, they were interested in his being a native of the town and the son of that Fyodor Pavlovich, and just then it was that the author himself made his appearance among us. Why Ivan Fyodorovich had come among us, I remember asking myself at the time with a certain uneasiness. This fateful visit, which was the first step leading to so many consequences, I never fully explained to myself. It seemed strange on the face of it that a young man so learned, so proud, and apparently so cautious, should suddenly visit such an infamous house, and a father who had ignored him all his life, hardly knew him, never thought of him, and would not under any circumstances have given him money, though he was always afraid that his sons Ivan and Alexei would also come to ask him for it. And here the young man was, staying in the house of such a father, had been living with him for 2 months, and they were on the best possible terms. This last fact was a special cause of wonder to many others, as well as to me. Peter Alexeyevich Miosavov, of whom we have already spoken, the cousin of Fyodor Pavlovich's first wife, happened to be in the neighbourhood again on a visit to his estate. He had come from Paris, which was his permanent home. I remember that he was more surprised than anyone when he made the acquaintance of the young man, who interested him extremely, and with whom he sometimes argued, and not without inner pang, compared himself in acquirements. "He is proud," he used to say. "He will never be in want of pence. He has got money enough to go abroad now. What does he want here? Everyone can see that he hasn't come from money, for his father would never give him any. He had no taste for drink and dissipation, and yet his father can't do without him. They get on so well together." That was the truth. The young man had an unmistakable influence over his father, who positively appeared to be behaving more decently, and even seemed at times ready to obey his son, though often extremely and even spitefully perverse. It was only later that he learned that Ivan had come partly at the request of and in the interests of his elder brother Dmitri, whom he saw for the first time on this very visit, though he had before leaving Moscow been in correspondence with him about an important matter of more concern to Dmitri than himself. What that business was, the reader will learn fully in due time. Yet, even when I did know of this special circumstance, I still felt Ivan Fyodorovitch to be an enigmatic figure, and thought his visit rather mysterious. I may add that Ivan appeared at the time in the light of a mediator between his father and his elder brother Dmitri, who was in open quarrel with his father, and even planning to bring an action against him. The family, I repeat, was now united for the first time, and some of its members met for the first time in their lives. The younger brother, Alexei, had been a year already among us, having been the first of the three to arrive. It is of that brother Alexei I find it most difficult to speak in this introduction, yet I must give some preliminary account of him, if only to explain one queer fact, which is that I have to introduce my hero to the reader wearing the cassock of a novice. Yes, he had been for the last year in our monastery, and seemed willing to be cloistered there for the rest of his life. All right, there we go. That is chapter 3 complete. Very cool stuff. Now, what I'm going to do, I just had this thought while I was reading, is I can go a quick little scroll of the next chapter and tell you guys now what I'm going to do. I am going to read chapter 4 in its entirety. It's 6.5 pages. It's a bit of a long one. That's probably about the maximum that I'll go in one go. So tomorrow we will read the whole of chapter 4. You can go ahead and read that if you're keen to read ahead. I was thinking this while I was reading, make a note of that wherever possible in the daily discussion. So in today's discussion about chapter 3, I will note that tomorrow we will read the whole chapter. That's a pretty simple solution to the question of how much to read in the next go. So cool. All right, thank you for listening today. Have your say about this chapter over at reddit.com/r/thehemingwaylist. Look forward to reading your comments there. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you tomorrow.